Byron wondered whether Natalie's irritable garrulity was due to the brandy. She was gesturing broadly, talking breathlessly, and her eyes were wild. "And there's still another complication, you know, the biggest."
"What's that?"
She stared at him. "Don't you know what it is, Briny? Haven't you any idea? Not the faintest inkling? Come on now, stop it." He said, or rather stammered, because the sudden penetrating sexuality in Natalie Jastrow's glance made him drunk, "I don't think I do."
"All right, then, I'll tell you. You've done it, you devil, and you know it. You've done what you've wanted to do from the first day you came here. I'm in love with you."
She peered at him, her eyes shining and enormous.
"Ye gods, what a dumb, stunned face! Don't you believe me?"
Very hoarsely, he said,
"I just hope it's true."
He got out of his chair and went to her. She jumped up, and they embraced.
"Oh, God," she said, clinging to him, and she kissed him and kissed him. "You have such a marvelous mouth," she muttered.
She thrust her hands in his hair. She caressed his face.
"Such a nice smile. Such fine hands. I love to watch your hands. I love the way you move. You're so sweet."
It was like 100 daydreams Byron had had, but far more intense and confusing and delicious. She was rubbing against him in crude, sensual delight, almost like a cat. The brown wool dress was scratchy in his hands. The perfume of her hair couldn't be daydreamed, nor the moist, warm, sweet breath of her mouth. Above all gleamed the inconceivable wonder that all this was happening. They stood, embraced by the crackling flames, kissing, saying broken, foolish sentences, whispering, laughing, kissing and kissing again. Natalie pulled away. She ran a few steps and faced him, her eyes blazing.
"Well, all right, I had to do that or die. I've never felt anything like this in my life, Byron. This maddening pull to you. I've been fighting it off and fighting it off because it's no damn good, you know. You're a boy. I won't have it. Not a Christian, not again. And besides," she put both hands over her face. Oh, don't look at me like that, Briny. Go out of my bedroom."
Byron turned to go, on legs almost caving under him. He wanted to please her. She said in the next breath,
"Christ, you're a gentleman. It's one of the unbelievable things about you. Would you rather stay? My darling. My love, I don't want to put you out. I want to talk some more. But I want to make some sense, that's all. And I don't want to make any false moves. I'll do anything you say. I absolutely adore you."
He looked at her standing in the firelight, in the long wool dress with her arms crossed, one leg out to a side, one hip thrust out, a typical Natalie pose. He was dazed with happiness beyond imagining, and flooded with gratitude for being alive.
"Listen, would you think of marrying me?" Byron said.
Natalie's eyes popped wide open and her mouth dropped. Byron could not help it. He burst out laughing at the comic change of her face, and that made her laugh crazily too. She came to him, almost flung herself at him, still laughing so uproariously that she could hardly manage to kiss him.
"God in heaven," she gasped, twining him in her arms. "You're incredible. That's two proposals in one day for La Jastro. It never rains but it pours, eh?"
"I'm serious," he said. "I don't know why we're laughing. I want to marry you. It's always seemed preposterous, but if you really do love me..."
"It is preposterous."
Natalie spoke with her lips to his cheek.
"Preposterous beyond words.
But where you're concerned, I appear to be quite mindless, and perhaps... Well, nobody can say you're a beardless boy, anyway. Quite sandpapery, aren't you?
She kissed him once more, hard, and loosened her arms.
The first idea was right. You leave. Good night, darling. I know you're serious, and I'm terribly touched. One thing we've got in this godforsaken place is time. All the time in the world.
In the darkness, on his narrow bed, in the tiny attic room, Byron lay wide awake. For a while he could hear her moving about below, then the house was silent. He could still taste Natalie's lips. His hands smelled of her perfume. Outside in the valley, donkeys hee-hawed to each other across the echoing slopes. A misguided rooster hailed a dawn hours away, and dogs barked. There came a rush of wind and a long drumming of rain on the tiles, and after a while, water dripped into the pail near his bed, under the worst leak. The rain passed, moonlight shafted faint and blue through the little round window, the pattering in the pail ceased, and still Byron lay with open eyes, trying to believe it. Trying to separate his dreams and fantasies of half a year from the real hour when Natalie Jastrow had overwhelmed him with endearments. Now his feverish mind ran on what he must do next. The window was turning violet when he fell asleep in a jumble of ideas and resolves, ranging from medical school and short story writing to the banking business in Washington. Some distant cousins of his mother did control a bank.
Hi, Natalie.
Oh, hi there. Sleep well? It was almost 11 when he hurried into the library. Byron was a hardened slug-a-bed, but he had not come down this late before. Three books lay open on Natalie's desk, and she was typing away. She gave him one ardent glance and went on with her work. Byron found on his desk a mass of first-draft pages heavily scribbled with Jastrow's corrections, to which was clipped a note in red crayon. "Let me have this material at lunch, please."
"A.J. looked in here 10 minutes ago," Natalie said, "and made vile noises."
Byron counted the pages. "He's going to make viler ones at lunch. I'm sorry, but I didn't close my eyes till dawn."
"Didn't you?" she said with a secret little smile. "I slept exceedingly well."
With a quick shuffling of papers and carbon, he began to type, straining his eyes at Jastrow's scrawl. A hand ran through his hair and rested warmly on his neck.
"Let's see."
She stood over him, looking down at him with affectionate amusement. Pinned on the old brown dress over her left breast was the gold brooch with purple stones from Warsaw. She had never before worn it. She glanced through the pages and took a few.
"Poor Briny. Why couldn't you sleep?"
"Never mind. Type your head off, and so will I." They did not finish the work before lunch, but by then, as it turned out, Dr. Jastrow had other things on his mind. At noon, an enormous white Lancia rattled the gravel outside the villa. Byron and Natalie could hear the rich voice of Tom Searle and the warm, hard laugh of his wife. Celebrated American actors, the Searles had been living off and on for 15 years in a hilltop villa not far from Jastrow's. The woman painted and gardened, while the man built brick walls and did the cooking. Endlessly they read old plays, new plays, and novels that might become plays. Other celebrities came to Siena just to see them. Through them, Jastrow had met and entertained Mom, Berenson, Gertrude Lawrence, and Picasso. A retired college professor would have been a minnow among these big fish, but the success of A Jew's Jesus had put him fairly in their company. He loved being part of the celebrities group, though he grumbled about the interference with his work.
He often drove down to Florence with the Searles to meet their friends, and Natalie and Byron thought the actors might be passing by now to fetch him off. But coming down for lunch, they found A.J. alone in the drawing room, sneezing, red-nosed, and waving an emptied sherry glass. He complained that they were late. In fact, they were a bit early. "The Searles are leaving," he said when lunch was over, having sneezed and blown his nose all through the meal without uttering a word. "Just like that. They came to say goodbye."
"Oh, are they doing a new play?" said Natalie.
"They're getting out. Lock, stock, and barrel. They're moving every stick back to the States."
"But doesn't their lease run for how many more years? 5?
7. They're abandoning the lease. They can't afford to get stuck here, they say, if the war spreads."
Jastrow morosely fingered his beard. "That's the one difference between leasing and buying. You just walk away. You don't bother your head about what happens to the place. I must say they urged me to lease. I should have listened to them. But the purchase price was so cheap."
Byron said, "Well, sir, if you think there's any danger, your skin comes first."
"I have no such fears. Neither have they. For them it's a matter of business. We'll have our coffee in the Lemon House."
With a peevish toss of his head, he lapsed into silence.
The Lemon House, a long glassed-in structure with a dirt floor, full of small potted citrus trees, looked out on a grand panorama of the town and the rounded brown hills. Sheltered here from cold winds that swept up the ravine, the trees throve in the pouring sunlight, and all winter long blossomed and bore fruit. Jastrow believed, contrary to every medical opinion, that the sweet, heavy scent of the orange and lemon blooms was good for the asthma that hit him when he was nervous or angry. Possibly because he believed this, it tended to work. His wheezing stopped while they drank their coffee. The warm sun cheered him up. He said,
"I predict they'll sneak back in short order with their tails between their legs, the 3 vans of furniture toiling up the hill. They remind me of the people who used to go fleeing off Martha's Vineyard at the first news of a hurricane. I sat through 4 hurricanes and thoroughly enjoyed the spectacle."
Natalie said after he left,
"He's badly shaken.
I hope he gets shaken loose from here.
Dear, this house will go to rack and ruin if A.J. leaves it."
"So what?"
"You've never owned anything, have you, Briny, or saved any money? Once you have, you may understand."
"Look, Natalie, A.J. had a windfall late in life and got carried away and bought himself a big Italian villa for a song, in a lonesome mountain town. All right, suppose he walks away now. If he offers it for sale, he'll get something for it. Otherwise, he can return after the war and put it back in shape. Or he can just forget it and let it fall down. Easy come, easy go."
"You see things so simply," she said.
They were sitting side by side on a white wicker couch. He started to put his arm around her.
"Stop that," she said, catching her breath and deflecting his arm. "That's too simple, too. Listen carefully, Byron. How old are you? Are you 25 yet? I'm 27.
"I'm old enough for you, Natalie."
"Old enough for what? To sleep with me? Don't talk rubbish. The question is, what are you doing with yourself?
I can teach at a university any time. I've got my M.A. thesis almost finished.
What have you got?
A smile that drives me mad and a handsome head of hair. You're brave, you're gentle, but you just drifted here. You only stayed because of me. You're killing time, and you're trained for nothing."
"Natalie, how would you like to be married to a banker?"
"A what? A banker?"
He told her about his relatives and their bank in Washington. Hands folded in her lap, she beamed at him, her face aglow in the sunshine. "How does that sound?" he said.
"Oh, fine," she said. "You're really facing up to life at last. A stern, serious business, isn't it? Tell me one thing."
"What?"
"Tell me when you decided you liked me."
"Don't you want to discuss this bank idea?"
"Of course, dear. All in good time. When was it?"
"All right, I'll tell you. When you took off your sunglasses."
"My sunglasses? When was that?"
"Why, that first day, when we came into the villa with Sloat. Don't you remember? You had these big dark glasses on in the car, but then you took them off, and I could see your eyes."
"So?
You asked me when I fell in love with you, I'm telling you."
"But it's so absurd, like everything else you say and do. What did you know about me?"
"Anyhow, my eyes must have been totally bloodshot. I'd been up till 4, having one hellish row with Leslie. You struck me as nothing at all, dear, so I didn't give a damn."
"Now look, you don't really want to be a banker, do you?"
He said, with an abashed grin, "Well, I did think of one other thing, but don't laugh at me."
"I won't."
"I thought of the Foreign Service. It's interesting, and it's serving the country."
"You and Leslie in the same service?" she said. "That would be a hot one."
She took his hand in a maternal way that depressed Byron.
"This isn't much fun for you, Briny dear, all this serious talk."
"That's okay," Byron said. "Let's go right on with it." For a moment she sat pondering, holding his hand in her lap, as she had in the Swedish ambassador's limousine.
"I'd better tell you what I really think. The trouble is, you are trained for something. You're a naval officer."
"That's the one thing I'm not, and I've made a career of not being."
"You already have a commission."
"I'm just a lowly reserve. That's nothing."
"If the war goes on, you'll be called up. You'll stay in for years.
That's what you'll probably be in the end, from sheer inertia and family custom and the passing of time." "I can resign my reserve commission tomorrow, shall I?"
"But suppose we get in the war, what then? Wouldn't you fight?"
"There's nothing else to do then." She put her hand in his hair and yanked it.
"Yes, that's how your mind works. Well, I love you for that, and for other things, but Byron, I'm not going to be the wife of a naval officer. I can't think of a more ridiculous and awful existence for me. I wouldn't marry a test pilot either, or an actor. Don't you understand?"
"It's no issue, I tell you. I'll never be a naval officer."
"What the devil? Now what? Why are you crying?"
She dashed the sudden tears from her face with the back of her hand, smiling.
"Oh, shut up. This is an insane conversation. The more I try to make sense, the wilder it all gets. All I know is that I'm crazy about you. If it's a dead end, who cares? I obviously thrive on dead ends. No, not now, love. Really, no."
She gasped the last words as he firmly took her in his arms. There was nobody in sight. Beyond the glass, there was only the panorama of hills and town, and inside the lemon house, silence and the heavy, sweet scent of the blossoms. They kissed and kissed, touching and holding and gripping each other. Soon, Natalie happened to glance up, and there stood the gardener, Giuseppe, outside the glass, leaning on a wheelbarrow full of cuttings, watching. With a squinting, inebriated leer, he wiped a sleeve of his sweater across his knobbed nose and obscenely winked.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," she said, yanking angrily at her skirt.
The gardener showed sparse, foul teeth in a grin and trundled the wheelbarrow away. Byron sat flushed, dazed, and disheveled, looking after him. Well, there goes our little secret, sweetheart. Kissing and smooching under glass. What's happened to me? This whole thing is a plain brute attraction between two people isolated together too long. She leaped to her feet and pulled at his hand. But I love you. I can't help it. I don't want to help it. Oh, that son of a bitch, Giuseppe. Come, let's get back to the rock pile. We must.
Jastrow called from his study as they came into the house. Natalie, where is your letter? May I read it?
What letter, AJ? I didn't get any mail.
Are you sure? I have one from your mother. She says she's written you another and much longer one. Come, read this. It's important.
He waved a flimsy airmail sheet as Byron went upstairs. There were only a half dozen lines in her mother's neat, featureless writing, a Manhattan public school script. Dear Aaron, we would both appreciate it if you would urge Natalie to come home. Lewis took that story of her trip to Poland very hard. The doctor even thinks that it may have been the cause of this attack. I've written Natalie all about it. You may as well read that letter. There's no sense in my repeating the whole terrible story. In retrospect, we were very lucky. Lewis seems in no immediate danger, but that's all the doctor will tell us. We're all wondering how long you yourself intend to stay on in Italy. Don't you feel it's dangerous? I know that you and Lewis have been out of touch all these years, but still he does worry about you. You're his one brother. Love, Sophie and Lewis. Natalie checked the mail piled on her desk in the library, but there was only one letter for her, from Sloat. Looking up from his work, Byron saw her somber expression. What is it, Natalie?
It's my father. I may have to leave.
The letter from her mother arrived 2 days later. Meantime, Natalie resumed a certain aloofness toward Byron, though she still wore the brooch, and looked at him with changed eyes. She took the long and somewhat frantic account of her father's heart attack to Jastrow, who was having his tea by the fire in the study, wrapped in a shawl. He shook his head sympathetically over it and handed it back to her. Gazing at the fire and sipping tea, he said, "You had better go."
"Oh, I think so. I'm practically packed."
"What was Lewis's trouble last time? Was it this bad?"
The brothers were deeply estranged. Natalie did not know exactly why, and this breaking of their long, tacit silence about her father gave her an awkward, unpleasant sensation.
"No, not really. The trouble was my announcement that I was in love with Leslie. Papa got awfully weak and had breathing difficulty and a blackout episode, but he wasn't hospitalized that time."
Jastrow pensively fingered his beard.
"He's only 61. You know, it gets to be suspenseful, Natalie, this question of whose heredity you've got. Our mother's family mostly popped off in their 50s, but father's two brothers both made it past 90, and he reached 88. My teeth are like my father's. I have excellent teeth. Lewis always had a lot of trouble with his teeth, the way Mama did."
Jastrow became aware of the girl's dark, watchful regard. He made a little apologetic gesture with both hands.
"You're thinking what a self-centered old horror AJ is."
"But I wasn't thinking that at all."
Jastrow put on cotton gloves to poke at the fire and throw on a fresh log. He was vain about his small, finely shaped hands.
"You won't come back. I know that. Life will get difficult here. Possibly I could go to New Mexico or Arizona, but there's such dull, arid, zero-culture places. The thought of trying to write there."
He gave a deep sigh, almost a groan.
"No doubt my books aren't that important. Still, the work is what keeps me going."
"Your books are important, AJ."
"Are they? Why?"
Natalie sat leaning her chin on a fist, groping for an honest and precise answer. She said, after a pause, "Of course, they're extremely readable and often brilliant, but that's not their distinction. Their originality lies in the spirit. The books are very Jewish, in a creditable, unsentimental way, in substance and in attitude. They've made me at least realize how very much Christendom owes this bizarre little folk we belong to. It's surprising how much of that you've gotten even to the Constantine book." Her words had a remarkable effect on Aaron Jastrow. He smiled, tremulously, his eyes misted, and he all at once did look strikingly Jewish. The mouth, the nose, the expression, the soft white hand at his beard, were all features of a hatless little rabbi. He spoke in a soft, shaky voice. "Of course you know exactly what to say to please me." "That's what I think, Aaron." "Well, bless you. I've evolved into a pagan, a materialist, and a hedonist. And I fell in love with the grandeur of Christianity and of Jesus long, long ago. But none of that has made me less Jewish. Nobody else in the family will accept that. Your father, least of all. I'm so grateful that you can. I truly think that the books on Constantine and Luther will round out the picture. I want to get them done. In my way, I'm bearing witness, as my rabbinic forebears did in theirs. Though, no doubt, they'd be horrified by me." He studied her face. He smiled, and his eyes began to twinkle. "How long after you left would Byron remain? He gives me such a secure feeling just by being here." "Give him a raise in salary. That'll convince him more than anything. He's never earned a penny before." Jastrow pursed his lips, rounded his eyes, and tilted his head. Many years of living in Italy showed in the mannerism. "I have to watch my money now. We'll see. My strong impression is, actually, that you'll marry Leslie once you get back there. And, oh, stop blushing and looking so coy. Have I hit it?" "Never mind, A.J. I'm sure if Byron were aware of that, he'd be more likely to stay on." Jastrow stroked his beard, smiling at her. "Good God, Aaron, do you expect me to tell Byron Henry I'm going to marry Sloat just to make him stay with you? Why, my dear, whoever suggested such a thing? Wait, my point is—" Jastrow stretched out a hand and looked after her, utterly astonished at her abrupt walkout. Chapter 20
"Holy cow!" Byron exclaimed. "There's my father, or his double."
"Where?" said Natalie. Her flight was delayed, and they were drinking coffee in the Rome airport at a table outside a little cafe, the same cafe where they had lunched before setting off for Warsaw. "Inside that ring of carabinieri over there." He pointed to a group of men leaving the terminal, escorted by six deferential police officers. Some of the party wore the green uniform of the foreign ministry. The rest were in civilian clothes. The military bearing of a short, broad-shouldered man in a pepper-and-salt suit and soft hat had caught Byron's eye. He stood, saying, "Can it be him? But why the devil didn't he write or wire me that he was coming to Italy? I'll take a look." "Briny!" He was starting to lope away. He stopped short.
"Yes?" "If it is your father. I'm so tacky and sooty from that horrible train ride, and he's obviously busy."
Natalie, usually so self-assured, suddenly looked confused and nervous, in an appealing, pathetic way.
"I wasn't expecting this. I'd rather meet him another time."
"Well, let's see if it's him." Victor Henry heard the voice behind him just as the party reached the exit doors.
"Dad! Dad! Wait up!"
Recognizing the voice, Pug turned, waved, and asked his escort from the ministry to wait for him.
D'accordo.
The Italian smiled and bowed, eyeing sharply the young man who was hurrying up.
I will accede to your luggage, Commander, and meet you outside. There is plenty of time.
The father and son clasped hands.
Well, how about this?
Victor Henry said, looking up at Byron's face with affection, as he usually concealed when less surprised.
What's up, Dad? Couldn't you let me know you were coming?
It happened, sudden-like. I intended to ring you tonight. What are you doing down here in Rome?
Natalie's going home. Her father's sick.
Oh, has she left already?
No, that's her, sitting over there.
That's the famous Natalie Jastrow, the one in gray.
No, further over, in black, with the big hat.
Victor Henry caught a new proprietary note in his son's voice. The listless, hangdog air of his Berlin days had given way to a confident glance and a straighter back.
"You're looking mighty bright-eyed and bushy-tailed," Pug said.
"I feel marvelous.
I'd like to meet that girl."
The father suddenly strode toward her, so fast that Byron had to take a running step or two to catch up.
There was no stopping him. They came and faced Natalie, who remained seated, hands clasped in her lap.
"Natalie, this is Dad."
With such a flat introduction, these two people, the opposed poles in Byron's life, all at once confronted each other.
Natalie offered her hand to Byron's father, looked him in the eye, and waited for him to speak. At first sight, Victor Henry was taken by this weary-looking, travel-stained girl with the dark eyes and gaunt face. She was not the legendary, adventurous Jewess he had built up in his imagination. She had an everyday American look. But withal there was a certain exotic aura and a strong, calm, feminine presence.
She must be feeling highly self-conscious, he thought, but there was no sign of it.
In her slight smile, as he took her hand, there was even a trace of reflected affection for Byron. He said,
"I'm sorry to hear about your father."
She nodded her thanks.
"I don't know how bad it is, but they want me at home, and so I'm going."
Her low voice was sweet, yet as firm as her look.
"Are you coming back?"
"I'm not sure. Dr. Jastrow may be returning to the States, too, you see."
"He'd be well advised to do that, fairly fast."
Pug was looking keenly at her, and she was meeting his glance. When neither found more to say for the moment, it became a sort of staring contest. Soon Natalie smiled a broad, wry, puckish smile, as though to say, "All right, you're his father, and I don't blame you for trying to see what's there. How do you like it?" This disconcerted Victor Henry. He seldom lost such eye-to-eye confrontations, but this time he shifted his glance to Byron, who was watching with lively interest, struck by Natalie's swift recovery of her poise.
"Well, Briny," he almost growled, "I ought to mosey along and not keep that foreign ministry type waiting."
"Right, Dad." Natalie said, "Byron told me that you became friendly with the Tudsburys in Berlin, Commander. I know Pamela."
"You do?"
Pug managed a smile. She was actually trying to put him at ease with small talk, and he liked that.
"Yes, in Paris, she and I used to date two fellows who shared the same flat. She's lovely."
"I agree, and very devoted to her father. Maniacal driver, though."
"Oh, did you find that out? I once drove with her from Paris to Chartres, and almost walked back. She scared me senseless."
"I guess it would take more than that to scare you."
Pug held out his hand.
"I'm glad I met you, even in this accidental way, Natalie."
Awkwardly, in almost a mumble, he added,
"It explains a lot. Happy landings. Flying all the way?"
I've got a seat on the Thursday Clipper out of Lisbon. I hope I don't get bumped.
You shouldn't. Things are quiet now. But you're well out of this continent. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Commander Henry.
Victor Henry abruptly walked off, with Byron hurrying at his elbow.
Briony, what about you now? You're staying on in Siena?
For the time being.
Do you know that Warren's engaged?
Oh, that's definite now.
Yes, they've set a date for May 20th, after he finishes his carrier training. I hope you'll count on getting back by then. You won't see any more brothers' weddings. I'm working on a leave for myself.
I'll certainly try. How's Mom?
Off her feed. Berlin's getting her down.
I thought she liked it.
It's becoming less likable.
They stopped at the terminal's glass doors.
How long will you be in Rome?
If I can see you, Dad, I'll just stay on till you're free.
Well, fine. Check in at the embassy with Captain Kirkwood. He's the naval attaché. Could be we'll dine together tonight.
Great.
That's some girl.
Byron smiled uncertainly.
Could you really tell anything?
What you never said is that she's so pretty.
What? I honestly don't think she is. Not pretty, exactly. I'm nuts about her, as you well know, but
she's got eyes you could drown in. She's stunning.
However, what I wrote you about her long ago still goes. Even more so, now that I've seen her. She's a grown-up woman.
He put his hand for a moment on Byron's shoulder.
No offense.
I love her.
Well, we won't settle that question here and now. Go back to her. She's sitting there all alone. And call Kirkwood about tonight.
I will.
Natalie's face was tense and inquiring when Byron came back. He fell into the chair beside her.
Gad, that was a shock. I still can't quite believe it. It all went so fast. He looks tired.
Do you know why he's here?
Byron shook his head slowly.
She said, I didn't picture him that way. He doesn't look severe. On the contrary, almost genial. But then, when he talks, he's scary.
He fell for you.
Byron, don't talk rot. Look at me, a soot-covered slattern.
He said something sappy about your eyes.
I don't believe it. What did he say?
I won't tell you. It's embarrassing. I never heard him say anything like it before.
What luck. He likes you.
Say, my brother's getting married.
Oh, when?
In May. She's the daughter of a congressman.
She doesn't seem all that concerned about marrying a naval officer.
Let's make it a double wedding.
Why not? You'll be manager of a bank by then, no doubt.
They were both smiling, but the unsettled questions between them put an edge in their tones. It was a relief when the droning loudspeaker announced her flight.
Byron carried her hand luggage and some fragile gifts for her family into the mill of jabbering, weeping passengers and relatives at the gate.
Natalie was clutching her ticket and trying to understand the shouts of the uniformed attendants. He attempted to kiss her, but it wasn't much of a kiss.
I love you, Natalie, he said.
She embraced him with one arm amid the jostling passengers and spoke over the tumult.
It's as well that I'm going home just now, I think. Meantime, I met your father. That was something.
He did like me, really?
You bowled him over, I tell you. And why not?
The crowd was starting to push through the gate.
How will I ever carry all this stuff? Load me up, sweetheart.
Promise you'll cable me if you decide not to come back, Byron said, poking bundles into her arms and under them. Because I'll take the next plane home.
Yes, I'll cable.
And promise that you'll make no other decisions, do nothing drastic, before you see me again.
Oh, Byron, how young you are, all these damned words. Don't you know how I love you?
Promise. Her dark eyes wet and huge, her hands and arms piled, the green and yellow ticket sticking out of her fingers. She shrugged, laughed, and said, "Oh, hell, it's a promise, but you know what Lenin said. Promises, like pie crusts, are made to be broken. Goodbye, my darling, my sweet. Goodbye, Byron." Her voice rose as the press of passengers dragged her away. After a couple of hours of troubled sleep at the hotel, Commander Henry put on a freshly pressed uniform, with shoes gleaming like black mirrors, and walked to the embassy. Under a low gray sky, in the rows of tables and chairs along the Via Veneto, only a few people were braving the December chill. The gasoline shortage had almost emptied the broad boulevard of traffic. Like Berlin, this capital city exuded penury and gloom. Captain Kirkwood had left for the day. His yeoman handed Pug a long, lumpy envelope. Two small objects clattered to his desk when he ripped it open. Silver eagles on pins. The collar insignia of a captain. "Captain William Kirkwood presents his compliments to Captain Victor Henry, and trusts he is free to dine at 9 at the Osteria del Orso. P.S. You're out of uniform. 4 stripes, please." Clipped to the note was a strip of gold braid and the all-nave letter listing newly selected captains, on which Victor Henry was ringed in heavy red lines. The yeoman's refreshing, freckled American face wore a wide grin.
"Congratulations, Cap'n."
"Thank you. Did my son call?"
"Yes, sir. He's coming to dinner. That's all arranged. I've got fresh coffee going, sir, if you'd like a cup in the captain's office."
"That'll be fine." Sitting in the attaché's swivel chair, Pug drank one cup after another of the rich navy brew, delightful after months of the German ersatz stuff. He ranged on the desk before him the eagles, the all-nave, the strip of gold braid. His seamed pale face looked calm, almost bored, as he swung the chair idly, contemplating the tokens of his new rank. But he was stirred, exalted, and above all, relieved. He had long been dreading that the selection board on this first round might pass over him. Execs of battleships and cruisers, squadron commanders of submarines and destroyers, insiders in Bueships and Bueord could well crowd out an attaché. The big hurdle of the race for flag rank was early promotion to captain. The few officers who became admirals had to make captain on the wing. This early promotion, this small, dry, irrevocable statistic in the record, was his guerdon for a quarter of a century of getting things done. It was his first promotion in 10 years, and it was the crucial one. He wished he could share this cheering news at once with his restless wife. Perhaps when he got back to Berlin they could throw a wingding, he thought, for embassy people, correspondents, and friendly foreign attachés, and lighten the gloom lying heavy in the Jew's mansion in Grunwald. Natalie Jastrow popped back into his mind, displacing even the promotion. Since the chance encounter, he kept thinking of her. In those few minutes he had sensed the powerful, perhaps unbreakable, bond between his son and the girl. Yet how could that be? Young women like Natalie Jastrow, if they went outside their natural age bracket, tended to marry a man almost his own age, rather than to reach down and cradle-snatch a stripling like Byron. Natalie was more mature and accomplished than Janice, who was marrying Byron's older brother. It was mismatch enough for these reasons, and made him wonder about her sense and stability. But the Jewish problem loomed above all. Victor Henry was no bigot, in his own best judgment. His narrowly bounded life had brought him into very little contact with Jews. He was an arid realist, and the whole thing spelled trouble. If he were to have half-Jewish grandchildren, well, with such a mother, they would probably be handsome and bright. But he thought his son was not man enough to handle the complications, and might never be. The coolness and courage he had displayed in Warsaw were fine traits for an athletic or military career, but in daily life they meant little, compared to ambition, industry, and common sense. "Mr. Gianelli is here, sir." The yeoman's voice spoke through the squawk box. "Very well." Victor Henry swept up the tokens and put them in a trouser pocket, not nearly as happy as he had once thought promotion to captain would make him. The San Francisco banker had changed to an elegant, double-breasted gray suit with bold chalk stripes and outsized British lapels. The interior of his green Rolls-Royce smelled of a strong cologne. "I trust you enjoyed your nap as much as I did mine," he said, lighting a very long cigar. All his gestures had the repose, and all the details of his person—manicure, rings, shirt, tie—the sleekness of secure wealth. Withal, he appeared stimulated and slightly nervous. "Now, I've already spoken to the foreign minister. You've met Count Ciano?" Pug shook his head. "I've known him well for many years. He's definitely coming to the reception, and from there we'll take me to the Palazzo Venezia. Now, what about you? What are your instructions?"
"To consider myself your aide as long as you're in Italy and Germany, sir, and to make myself useful in any way you desire."
"Do you understand Italian?"
"Poorly, to say the least. I can grope through a newspaper if I have to."
"That's a pity." The banker smoked his cigar with calm relish, his drooping eyes sizing up Victor Henry. "Still, the president said there might be value in having you along at both interviews, if these heads of state will stand for it. Just another pair of eyes and ears. At Carinhall, of course, I can ask that you interpret for me. My German's a bit weak. I think we'll have to feel our way as we go. This whole errand is unusual, and there's no protocol for it. Ordinarily, I'd be accompanied by our ambassador."
"Suppose I just come along then, as though it's the natural thing, unless they stop me."
The banker's eyes closed for several seconds, then he nodded and opened them. "Ah, there's the forum. You've been in Rome before? We're passing the Arch of Constantine. A lot of old history here. I suppose envoys came to Rome in those days on errands just as strange."
Pug said, "This reception now, is it at your apartment?"
"Oh, no, I keep just a very small flat off the Via Veneto. My uncle and two cousins are bankers here. It is at their townhouse, and reception is for me. Let us just see how this goes. If, when we're with Ciano, I touch my lapel, so you'll excuse yourself. Otherwise, come along in the way you suggest." These arrangements proved needless, because Mussolini himself dropped in on the party. About half an hour after the arrival of the Americans, a commotion started up at the doorway of the enormous marble-columned room, and Il Duce came walking bouncily in. He was not expected, judging by the excitement and confusion among the guests. Even Ciano, resplendent in green, white, and gold uniform, seemed taken aback. Mussolini was a surprisingly small man, shorter than Pug, dressed in a wrinkled tweed jacket, dark trousers, a sweater, and brown and white saddle shoes. It struck Pug at once that with this casual apparel Mussolini was underlining, perhaps for its eventual effect on the Germans, his contempt for Roosevelt's informal messenger. Mussolini went to the buffet table, ate fruit, drank tea, and chatted jauntily with guests who crowded around. He moved through the room with a teacup, talking to one person and another. He glanced once at Luigi Gianelli as he passed close by, but otherwise he ignored the two Americans. In this setting, Mussolini hardly resembled the chin-jutting imperial bully with the demonic glare. His prominent eyes had an Italian softness. His smile was wide, ironical, very worldly, and it seemed to Victor Henry that here was a smart little fellow who had gotten himself into the saddle and loved it, but whose bellicosity was a comedy. There was no comparing him with the ferocious Hitler. Mussolini left the room while Pug was clumsily making talk with the banker's aunt, a bejeweled, painted crone with a haughty manner, a peppermint breath, and almost no hearing. Seeing the banker beckon to him and walk off after Ciano, Pug excused himself and followed. The three men went through tall, carved wooden doors into a princely, high-ceilinged library, lined with volumes bound in gold-stamped brown, scarlet, or blue leather. Tall windows looked out over the city, which appeared so different from blacked-out Berlin, with electric lights twinkling and blazing in long crisscrossing lines and scattered clusters. Mussolini, with a regal gesture, invited them to sit. The banker came to the sofa beside him, while Ciano and Victor Henry faced them in armchairs. Mussolini coldly stared at Henry and turned the stare to Gianelli. The look at once changed Pug's impression of the Italian leader and gave him a forcible sense that he was out of his depth and under suspicion. He felt junior and shaky, an ensign who had blundered into flag country. Ciano had given him no such feeling, and still didn't, sitting there, gorgeous and wary, the son-in-law waiting for the powerful old man to talk. At this close range, Pug could see how white Mussolini's fringe of hair was, how deep the creases of decision were folded in his face, how vivid were the large eyes, which now had an opaque glitter. This man could readily order 100 murders, Pug decided, if he had to. He was an Italian ruler. Pug could half follow the banker's clear, measured Italian as he rapidly explained that Franklin Roosevelt, his treasured friend, had appointed the Berlin naval attaché as an aide for his few days in Europe, also that Henry would be acting as interpreter with Hitler. He said Henry could now remain or withdraw at Il Duce's pleasure. Mussolini gave the attaché another glance, this time obviously weighing him as a Roosevelt appointee. His expression warmed. "Do you speak Italian?" he said in good English, catching Henry unawares, almost as though a statue had broken into speech. "Excellency, I can follow it in a fashion. I can't speak it. But then I have nothing to say." Mussolini smiled, as Pug had seen him smile at people in the other room. "If we come to naval matters, maybe we will talk English." He looked expectantly at the banker. "Bene, Luigi." The banker talked for about a quarter of an hour. Since Pug already knew the substance, the banker did not altogether lose him. After some compliments, Gianelli said he was no diplomat and had neither the credentials nor the skill to discuss matters of state. He had come to put one question informally to Il Duce on behalf of the president. Mr. Roosevelt had sent a private citizen who knew Il Duce so that a negative reply would not affect formal relations between the United States and Italy. The president was alarmed by the drift toward catastrophe in Europe. If full-scale war broke out in the spring, horrors that nobody could foresee might engulf the whole world. Was it possible to do something, even at this late hour? Mr. Roosevelt had in mind a formal, urgent mission by a high United States diplomat, somebody on the order of Sumner Wells. Ciano, drumming the tips of his fingers together, looked up at the mention of the name. To visit all the chiefs of the warring states, perhaps late in January, to explore the possible terms of a general European settlement. Il Duce himself had made a last-minute call for a similar exploration on August 31st, in vain. But if he would join the president now in bringing about such a settlement, he would hold a place in history as a savior of mankind. Mussolini deliberated for a minute or so, his face heavy, his shoulders bowed, his look withdrawn, one hand fiddling with his tweed lapels. Then he said, as nearly as Pug could follow him, that the foreign policy of Italy rested on the Pact of Steel, the unshakable tie with Germany. Any attempt, any maneuver, any trick designed to split off Italy from this alliance would fail. A settlement in Europe was always possible. No one would welcome it more than he. As Mr. Roosevelt acknowledged, he himself had tried to the last to preserve the peace. But Hitler had offered a very reasonable settlement in October, and the Allies had spurned it. The American government in recent years had been openly hostile to Germany and Italy. Italy, too, had serious demands that had to be part of any settlement. These were not matters in Luigi's province, Mussolini said, but he was stating them to clarify his very pessimistic feeling about a mission by Sumner Wells. "You have put the question to me," he concluded. "Now, Luigi, I will put the question to you." "Yes, Duce." "Does this initiative come from a President Roosevelt, or is he acting at the request of the Allies?"
"Duce, the President has told me this is his own initiative."
Ciano cleared his throat, leaned forward with his hands clasped, and said,
"Do the British and French know and approve of this visit you are making?"
"No, Excellency. The President said that he would be making informal inquiries of the same nature at this same time in London and Paris."
Mussolini said,
"The newspapers have no information on any of this. Is that correct?"
"What I have told you, Duce, is known outside this room only to the President and his Secretary of State. My trip is a matter of private business, of no interest to the press, and so it will remain forever."
"I have stated my deep reservations," said Mussolini, speaking slowly, in an extremely formal tone. "I have very little hope that such a mission would be to any useful purpose, in view of the maniacal hostility of the British and the French ruling circles to the resurgent Germany nation and its great Führer. But I share Mr. Roosevelt's sentiment about leaving no stone unturned."
He took a long, portentous pause, then spoke with a decisive nod.
"If the President sends Sumner Wells on such a mission, I will receive him."
Gianelli's fixed smile gave way to a real one of delight and pride. He gushed over Mussolini's wise and great decision, and his joy at the prospect of Italy and the United States, his two mother countries, joining to rescue the world from tragedy. Mussolini nodded tolerantly, seeming to enjoy the flood of flattery, though he waved a deprecating hand to calm down the banker. Victor Henry seized the first pause in the banker's speech to put in,
"Duce, may I ask whether Signor Gianelli is permitted to tell the Führer this, that you have consented to receive a formal mission by Sumner Wells?"
Mussolini's eyes sparked, as sometimes an admiral's did when Victor Henry said something sharp. He looked to Ciano. The foreign minister said condescendingly, in his perfect English, "The Führer will know long before you have a chance to tell him."
"Okay," said Henry.
Mussolini rose, took Gianelli's elbow, and led him out through French doors to the balcony, letting a gust of cold air into the room. Ciano smoothed his thick black hair with both white hands.
"Well, Commander, what do you think of the great German naval victory in the South Atlantic?"
"I hadn't heard of one."
"Really? It will be on Rome radio at 7 o'clock. The battleship Graf Spee has caught a group of British cruisers and destroyers off Montevideo. The British have lost 4 or 5 ships, and all the rest have been damaged. It's a British disaster that changes the whole balance of force in the Atlantic."
Victor Henry was shocked, but skeptical.
"What happened to Graf Spee?"
"A minor hit that will be repaired overnight. Graf Spee was much heavier than anything it faced."
"The British have acknowledged this?" Count Ciano smiled. He was a good-looking young man, and obviously knew it. Just a little too fat and proud, Pug thought, from living high on the hog.
"No, but the British took a little while to acknowledge the sinking of the Royal Oak."
The dinner, celebrating Victor Henry's promotion, began in gloom because of the Graf Spee news. The two attachés sat talking over highballs, waiting for Byron to show up. Captain Kirkwood asserted that he believed the story, that in the 20 years since the last war, a deep rot had eaten out the heart of England. Kirkwood looked like an Englishman himself, long-jawed, ruddy, and big-toothed, but he had little use for Great Britain. The British politicians had stalled and cringed in the face of Hitler's rise, he declared, because they sensed their people no longer had a will to fight. The limey navy was a shell. England and France were going to crumple under Hitler's onslaught in the spring.
"It's too bad, I suppose," Kirkwood said. "One's sentiments are with the Allies, naturally, but the world moves on. After all, Hitler halted communism in its tracks. And don't worry, once he takes the fight out of the Allies, he'll settle Stalin's hash. The Russians are putting on one stumble-bum performance in Finland, aren't they? There'll be a walkover for the Wehrmacht. In the end, we'll have to make a deal with Hitler. That's becoming obvious. He holds all the cards on this side of the water."
"Hi, Dad." Byron's sports jacket and slacks were decidedly out of place in this old, luxurious restaurant where half the people wore evening dress. Henry introduced him to the attaché.
"Where have you been? You're late."
"I saw a movie and then went to the YMCA to flake out for a little while."
"Is that all you could find to do in Rome? See a movie? I wish I had a few free hours in this city."
"Well, see, I was tired." Byron appeared much more his old slack self. The waiter now brought champagne, and Kirkwood proposed a toast to Captain Victor Henry.
"Hey, Dad, 4 stripes, really?"
Byron sprang to life, radiating surprised joy. He clasped his father's hand and lifted a brimming glass.
"Well, I'm sure glad I came to Rome, just for this. Say, I know one doesn't mention such things, but the hell with it. Doesn't this put you way out front, Dad?"
Captain Kirkwood said,
"He's been out front all along. That's what this means."
"All it takes now is one false move," said Pug dryly, shaking his head. "One piece of bad luck. One mislaid dispatch, one helmsman doping off on the midwatch. You're never out front till you retire."
"What's your situation, by the way, Byron?"
Kirkwood said. The young man hesitated.
"He's ROTC," Pug quickly said. "He's got a yen for submarines. By the way, Briny, the New London sub-school is doubling the enrollment in May and accepting any reserves that can pass the physical."
Kirkwood smiled, examining Byron with a shade of curiosity.
"Now's the time to get in on the ground floor, Byron. How are your eyes? Got 20/20 vision?"
"My eyes are okay, but I have this job to do here."
"What sort of job?"
"Historical research." Kirkwood's face wrinkled. Pug said,
"He's working for a famous author, Aaron Jastrow, you know, the one who wrote Jews Jesus."
"Oh, Jastrow, yes, that fellow up in Siena. I had lunch with him at the embassy once. Brilliant fellow. Having some trouble getting back home, isn't he?"
Byron said, "He isn't having trouble, sir, he just doesn't want to leave." Kirkwood rubbed his chin.
"Are you sure? Seems to me that's why he was in Rome. Is a foul-up in his papers. He was born in Russia or Lithuania or somewhere, and whatever it is, I guess something can be worked out. Taught at Yale, didn't he?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, he ought to make tracks while he can. Those Germans are just over the Alps. Not to mention old Benito's anti-Jew laws."
Victor Henry was returning to Berlin that night by train, accompanying the banker. He said nothing about his mission in Rome to Kirkwood or his son, and they did not ask. After dinner, Byron rode to the railroad station in the taxi with him, in a prolonged silence. Natalie Jastrow was a heavy, invisible presence in the cab, and neither one would start the topic. Pug said as they drove into the brilliantly lit empty square before the terminal,
"Briny, if the British really took that shellacking off Montevideo, we won't stay out much longer. We can't let the Germans close the Atlantic. That's 1917 again. Why don't you put in for sub-school? It won't start until May. By then, Jastrow will be back in the States, if he isn't simple-minded."
"May's a long way off."
"Well, I'm not going to argue."
Pug got out of the cab.
"Write to your mother a little more often. She's not happy."
"Okay, Dad."
"Don't miss Warren's wedding."
"I'll try not to. Gosh, won't that be something if this family finally gets together again?"
"That's why I want you there. It'll be the last time in God knows how many years. Goodbye."
"Goodbye. Listen, I'm real proud you made captain, Dad."
Pug Henry gave his son a gloomy half-smile through the cab window and walked off to the train. And still, not a word more had passed between them about the Jewish girl.
Chapter 21. So irascibly did Rhoda Henry greet her husband on his return that he began to think something might be wrong with her. He had left her in a nervous slump. Everything was an aggravating mess. The fall weather in Berlin stank. Life stank. She was bored. German efficiency was a fiction. Nobody understood how to do anything right. And there were no service and no honesty anymore. She had her pain, an untreatable affliction that during previous slumps had showed up in an arm and in her back, and now was behind an ear. She feared cancer, but it didn't really matter because everything good was all finished anyway. Rhoda had always come out of these sags before and then could be contritely sweet. Pug had hoped, when he suddenly left Berlin for Rome, that he would find her better when he got back. She was worse. She wanted to go with him to Carinhall. In his absence, an invitation engraved in gold on creamy thick stationery, addressed to Commander Victor Henry, had been delivered by a Luftwaffe staff officer. Pug hadn't been home 10 minutes when she brought it out, wanting to know why she hadn't been invited too. If he went to the Goering's party at Carinhall and left her behind, she said, she could never face anybody in Berlin again. Pug could not disclose that he was going along for secret state purposes, as a flunky to an international financier. He couldn't take her into the snow-covered garden to soothe her with hints of this. It was almost midnight, and she was wearing a cloudy blue negligee, in which, indeed, she looked very pretty. "Listen, Rhoda, take my word for it that there are security reasons for all this."
"Ha! Security reasons! That old chestnut! Whenever you want to do anything your way!"
"I'd rather have you along, you know that."
"Prove it! Call the protocol officer at the Air Ministry tomorrow, or if you're too bashful, I will."
Pug was conducting this conversation in the library while glancing through piled-up mail. He put down the letters. After a minute of cold staring at his wife, he said, "Are you well?"
"I'm bored to death.
Otherwise, I'm fine. Why?" "Have you been taking the iron pills?"
"Yes, but I don't need pills. What I need is a little fun. Maybe I should go on a bender."
"You're not calling the Air Ministry. I hope that's understood." Rhoda made a mutinous noise and sat pouting. "Hello, here's a letter from that Kirby fellow. What's he got to say for himself?"
"Read it. It's as dull as he is. All about how glad he is to be home, and how good the skiing is around Denver, and how much he enjoyed our hospitality. 3 pages of nothing."
Pug tossed the letter unread on the routine pile.
"Honestly, you're a riot. You're so predictable, Pug. For 25 years, whenever you've come home, you've gone straight for the mail. What are you expecting, a letter from a lost love?"
He laughed and shoved the letters aside. "Right you are. Let's have a drink. Let's have a couple of drinks. You look wonderful."
"I do not. That goddamned hairdresser baked my hair into shredded wheat again. I'm tired. I've been waiting up to talk to you. You were 2 hours late."
"There was trouble at the passport office."
"I know. Well, I'm going to bed. Nothing to talk about, since Carinhall is out. I even bought a sensational dress. I was going to show it to you, but to hell with it. I'll send it back."
"Keep it. You might just find a use for it pretty soon."
"Oh, expect to be invited to the Goerings again?"
She went out without staying for an answer. Pug prepared a couple of highballs to toast the news of his promotion. When he got upstairs, her light was out. An old, unpleasant marital signal. He wanted very much to spend the night with his wife. Moreover, he had been saving the story of his encounter with Natalie Jastrow for their bedroom talk. He drank both highballs himself and slept on the sofa in the library. The next day was brightened for him by the German announcement that the Graf Spee had heroically scuttled itself after its historic victory, and that its commanding officer had then nobly shot himself in a hotel room. He heard over the BBC that 3 much lighter British vessels had in fact beaten the German warship in a running sea fight and sent it limping into port before the scuttling. The German people didn't hear a word of this, and they were baffled by the revelation that the victorious pocket battleship had elected to blow itself up. The Nazi propagandists did not bother to explain, smothering the story instead with a whooping account of a vast, fictitious air victory. 25 British bombers shot down over Heligoland. Pug knew that the chances of his ever meeting Count Ciano again were remote, but he would have given much to chat with him again about the Graf Spee. Also, when Rhoda learned of Pug's promotion, she came out of her blues as though by shock. Not another peep did she utter about Carinhall. She proceeded to give him the honeymoon treatment, and they had a happy week or so.
His account of Natalie Jastrow fascinated and appalled her. "Sounds to me as though our only hope is that she'll come to her senses and drop Briny," she said. Carring Hall looked like a federal penitentiary built in the style of a hunting lodge. It sat in a game preserve about 2 hours' drive from Berlin, a wilderness of small bare trees and green firs mantled in snow. Off the Autobahn, the approach ran through heavy gates electrically controlled, steel and concrete fences jagged with icicles, and a gauntlet of machine-gun-bearing Luftwaffe sentinels whose breath smoked as they shouted challenges. Just as the car turned a corner and they caught a glimpse of the grandiose timber and stone building, a deer with big, frightened eyes bounded across the road. The San Francisco banker no longer wore his automatic smile. His mouth was tightly pursed, and the soft brown Italian eyes were open wide and darting here and there, rather like the deer's. In the vaulted banquet room, amid a dazzling crush of uniformed Nazis and their white-shouldered women, some lovely, some grossly fat, all brilliantly gowned and heavily gemmed, Adolf Hitler was playing with the little Goering girl. A string orchestra lost in a corner of the marble-paved expanse was murmuring Mozart. Great logs flamed in a fireplace with a triangular stone pediment soaring to the ceiling. And on a carved heavy table, stretching the entire length of the room, an untouched banquet lay piled. Rich smells hung in the air. Wood smoke, cigar smoke, roast meat, French perfume. The happy, excited crowd of eminent Germans were laughing, cooing, clapping hands, their eyes shining at their leader in his plain field-gray coat and black trousers as he held the beautiful white-clad child in his arms, talking to her, teasing her with a cake. Goering and his statuesque wife, both ablaze in operatic finery and jewelry, the man more showy than the woman, stood near, beaming with soft, affectionate pride. Suddenly the little girl kissed the Führer on his big, pale nose, and he laughed and gave her the cake. A cheer went up, everybody applauded, and women wiped their eyes.
"The Führer is so wonderful," said the Luftwaffe officer accompanying the two Americans, a small, dark aviator wearing the diamond-studded cross of the Condor Legion.
"Ach, if only he could marry! He loves children."
And to Pug Henry, also, there was something appealing about Hitler. His shy smile, acknowledging the applause, the jocular reluctance with which he had handed the girl to her ecstatic mother, his wistful shrug as he slapped Goering's back, like any bachelor congratulating a luckier man. At this moment, Hitler had a naive, almost mushy charm. The Goerings escorted Hitler to the table, and this signaled a general swarming toward the buffet. A troop of lackeys in blue and gold livery marched in, setting up gilt tables and chairs, helping the guests to food, pouring the wine, bowing and bowing. Guided by the Luftwaffe officer, he and Gianelli landed at a table with a banker named Wolf Stoller, who hailed the American financier as an old acquaintance, a slight Teuton in his 50s, with sandy hair plastered close to his head. The wife, an ashen-haired beauty, had eyes that glittered clear blue like the large diamonds on her neck, her arms, her fingers, and her ears. By chance, Victor Henry had just written a short report on Stoller and knew a lot about him. Stoller's bank was the chief conduit by which Goering was amassing his riches. Stoller's specialty was acquiring Objekte, the term in German business jargon for Jewish-owned companies forced to the wall. In the queer Germany of 1939, which Victor Henry was just beginning to understand, there was much stress on legality in looting the Jews.
Outright confiscation or violence were rare. New codes of law dating from 1936 simply made it hard for them to do business, and month by month rulings came out making it even harder. Jewish firms couldn't get import or export licenses or raw materials. Their use of railroads and shipping was restricted. Conditions kept tightening until they had no course but to sell out. A market flourished in such Objekte, with many alert upper-class Germans bidding eagerly against each other. Wolf Stuhler's technique was to find and unite all the buyers interested in an object and to make a single, very low offer. The owners had the choice of taking it or going bankrupt. Stuhler's group then divided up the firm in shares. Through Goering, Stuhler had access to the Gestapo's records and was usually first on the scent of a major Jewish firm buckling to its knees. The big prizes Goering bought up himself: metal, banking, textiles, or took a large participation. Stuhler's bank got its broker's fees and also its own participations in the Objekte. All this Pug had learned from the American radio commentator in Berlin, Fred Fearing, who had been at some pains to dig it up. Fearing recounted it to him with deep anger, the more so as he couldn't broadcast the story. The Germans claimed that any report of unfair treatment of the Jews was paid Allied propaganda. The Jewish laws aimed simply at restricting this minority, they said, to its due share in German's economy. Pug had more or less shut his mind to the Jewish problem, so as to focus on the military judgments, which were his job. Jews had become all but invisible in Berlin, except in their special shopping hours, when, pallid and harried, they briefly filled the stores and then again faded from sight. The oppression was not a highly visible affair. Pug had never seen even the outside of a concentration camp. He had observed the signs on benches and restaurants, the white-faced, worried wretches pulled off trains and airplanes, an occasional broken window or old, charred synagogue, and once a bad business of a man beaten bloody in the zoo by three boys in Hitler Youth uniforms, while the man's wife wept and screamed, and two policemen stood by laughing. But Fearing's account was his first technical insight into German antisemitism. At bottom, its purpose, in Fearing's view, was just robbery, which was disgusting but at least rational. Pug felt a qualm when Wolf Stuhler, with a cultured bow, offered his hand, but, of course, he took it. And soon, there they sat, eating together and toasting each other in Moselle, Riesling, and Champagne. Stuhler was a cordial, clever German, in every way indistinguishable from the hundreds that Victor Henry had met in the military and industrial worlds and at social gatherings. He spoke a fine English. His countenance was open and hearty. He made bright jokes, including bold pleasantries about Goering's corpulence and theatrical uniforms. He expressed deep regard for the United States. He especially loved San Francisco, and melancholy regret that its relations with Germany were not better. In fact, could he not do something to improve them, he said, by inviting Gianelli and the Henrys for a weekend at his estate? It was no Carinhall, but he could promise them good company. Captain Henry might have the luck to shoot a deer. Game was outside the meat ration, and some venison might be very welcome to Mrs. Henry. The banker's wife, touching Pug's hand with her cool, jeweled white fingers, crinkled her blue eyes at him in invitation. She had heard that Mrs. Henry was the most elegant and attractive wife in the American diplomatic mission, and she longed to meet her. Gianelli declined. He had to start his return journey in the morning. Officially, there was every reason for Victor Henry to accept. Part of his job was to penetrate influential levels of Germans. He had no stomach for Stirler, but it occurred to him that there was a chance to give Rhoda the kind of fun she complained of missing. There was no telling good Germans from bad Germans. Stirler conceivably might be working for Goering under duress, though his wife, in consequence, dripped diamonds. Pug said he would come. The look the Stirlers exchanged convinced him that none of this was casual. They were cultivating him. Stirler took the two Americans on a tour of Carinhall. Again, Pug had the feeling that Nazi grandeur usually woke in him. The Hollywood impression. The sense of ephemeral, flamboyant make-believe, which persisted no matter how vast and solid the structures, how high the ceilings, how elaborate the decorations, how costly the art. The corridors and rooms of Carinhall seemed to go on for miles. Glass cases by the dozens displayed solid gold objects crusted with gems, vases, crosses, maces, swords, busts, batons, medals, books, globes, tributes to the field marshal from steel corporations, cities, and foreign governments on his birthday, his wedding, the birth of a child, the return of the Condor Legion from Spain. Italian and Dutch old masters crowded the walls, interspersed with the vapid calendar nudes of living Nazi-approved painters. Other reception rooms with nobody in them, almost as vast and ornate as the banquet hall, were hung with tapestries and flags, walled in wood, filled with statuary and jeweled suits of armor. Yet it all might almost have been papier-mâché and canvas. Even the food on the banquet table had looked like a Cecil B. DeMille feast, and the pink meat inside the roast pig might instead have been wax or plaster. But Victor Henry well knew that he was looking at an immense treasure, mostly booty, collected through Dr. Stirler. Moral considerations aside, the vulgar edifice disappointed Pug because Goering was supposed to stem from an aristocratic family. Even the admiring comments of Luigi Gianelli had a strong tinge of irony. The Luftwaffe officer wearing the diamond cross caught up with them and whispered to Stirler.
"Ah, what a pity, now you must go," said the German banker. "And you haven't begun to see the wonders of Carinhall. Captain Henry, my office will make all the arrangements to bring you and your dear wife on Friday to Abendroo, though I fear it will look rather pitiful after this. We will telephone you tomorrow."
Stirler accompanied the two Americans through more rooms and corridors, stopped at double doors of dark wood, heavily carved with hunting scenes, and opened them on a timbered room with log and plaster walls, hung with antlers, stuffed heads, and animal hides. The dusty smell of the dead creatures was strong in the air. On either side of a roaring fire sat Ribbentrop and Goering. Hitler was not in the room. A long, crudely made wooden table and two low benches took up most of the floor space. Pug thought at once that this must be the main room of the old hunting lodge, around which the field marshal had constructed the banal palace. Here was the heart of Carinhall. Except for the glow from the fire, the room was dank, dark, and cold. Goering lolled on a settee with one thick, white, leather-booted leg off the floor, sipping coffee from a gold demitasse, part of a gold service on a low inlaid marble table. He nodded and smiled familiarly at Gianelli. Diamond rings bulged on three of the five fingers that held the cup. Ribbentrop stared at the ceiling, hands interlaced across his stomach. The German banker introduced Victor Henry, backed out of the room, and closed the door.
"You will have exactly 7 minutes of the Führer's time to state your business," said Ribbentrop in German.
Gianelli stammered,
Excellency, permit me to reply in English. I am here in a private capacity, and I regard that much time as an extraordinary courtesy to my country and my president. Ribbentrop sat with a blank face, looking at the ceiling, so Victor Henry ventured to translate. The foreign minister cut him off with a snapped sentence in perfect Oxford accents. "I understand English." Goering said to Gianelli,
"You are welcome to Carin Hall, Luigi. I have tried to invite you more than once, but this time you have come a long way for a short interview."
"May I say, Field Marshal," the banker answered in broken German, "that I have seen millions of money made and lost in a conference lasting a few minutes, and that world peace is worth any effort, however unpromising."
"I am in complete agreement with that."
Goering motioned them to chairs placed near him. Ribbentrop, seizing the arms of his chair and closing his eyes, burst out in high, rapid tones, in German,
"This peculiar visitation is another studied insult by your president to the German head of state. Who ever heard of sending a private citizen as an emissary in such matters? Between civilized countries, the diplomatic structure is used. Germany did not withdraw its ambassador in Washington by choice. The United States first made the hostile gesture. The United States has allowed within its borders a boycott of German products and a campaign of hate propaganda against the German people. The United States has revised its so-called Neutrality Act in blatant favor of the aggressors in this conflict. Germany did not declare war on England and France. They declared war on Germany."